FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth. Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 12, Episode 46, The Route. This week, we heard Bob break down the available sector data. After plotting the times and sector data, Bob gave us his hypothesis on Robert and Christian's possible route for the evening in question. We have a lot of your questions to dig into this week, so after a short break, Bob, Janet, and myself will dive into them here on Truth and Justice.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alrighty, thanks everybody for joining us today. As I'm sure Zach mentioned in the intro, we have Janet joining us today via Zoom. Zach and I are both in the room, and we are joined by, looks like, 100 or more people on the YouTube Live. Thank you guys all for joining us as well. This week's episode, we're going to be talking about the route. I've got a couple things that I want to talk about up front that I don't think made it into the questions. But before I do that, this was an interesting one for me. Didn't see a lot of feedback from the episode. For me, this was a huge eye-opener for me, but that was because I was going through this process and looking at how all these calls tracked. Janet, what did you think as you were listening? How did it translate to the audio when you were listening to it?
Well, I took your advice and looked at the map while you were taking us through it. You were very careful to make sure that you told people to do that, and you sort of touched back on that a few times during the episode, and it was really important. I think trying to listen to it without that, you get the sense that, you know, you've figured out what is possible with respect to those early calls. And there's been so much speculation about where they were, what choices they made, especially because they didn't necessarily remember some of the choices that didn't matter. So there's a lot of theories out there. And it seemed like you were really able to nail down where they were thanks to that sector data. So it continues to pay off, right?
I think so. I guess it's a good thing there wasn't a lot of feedback, because one thing that I asked listeners to do, and our audience is great about doing this stuff, is look at the data, look at the cell coverage, and see if there's another route that I'm missing. Because I landed on that route. There's people all the time telling me what they think happened. And what I tried to do with this is ignore literally all of that. And just look at what the sector data shows, like where can we track where they're moving? Because there was a few things, like there were a lot of people prior to this that said that they thought that Robert and Christian probably turned on Country Club and went down Cook or down Monterey or somewhere down there, heading to Sacred Heart. So that was one of the things I looked at and was like, no, like despite the fact that a lot of people believed that, I could disprove that. It's not possible. Just like kind of the other side, we're like, well, we think they went down 74. I was able to look at this and show definitively that that's not what happened. One of the things, and I'm going to get to you in just a second, Zach, that I want to talk about too, because there was a question, I don't think it made the follow-up, but someone asked me directly on Facebook, was they were confused by, and if you're looking at the map, the 653 call, where I said that, you know, that call connected to Tower 707 Sector 3. And you can see that call is slightly outside of the arc there, which, you know, I don't think anybody had an issue with that, because they're like, well, okay, so, but the question was, well, if that can be outside the arc, meaning, you know, because there's overlapping coverage and it could catch there, then why couldn't the 713 call have done the same thing? Whereas Highway 74 is outside of the arc that I made, but why couldn't that have caught there as well with the same principle? And the thing is, we're talking about two different things. With the 653 call up there by that arc, we're just looking at, we know there was a call, we know it connected to that sector, and we know where they were going. That's close. that, and there is overlapping coverage beyond what I drew in the arcs, as I mentioned. So that's the only place where they could have connected to that tower, and that works. The other call at 7:13, there are a whole gamut of other issues. One being that, yes, the Highway 74 is outside of the coverage arc I drew, but more importantly, it's outside of the drive test that Gillette did for Gladiator. He showed conclusively in multiple different drive tests and multiple different maps, and every single one showed that Sector 1 of 705 does not have any coverage on Tower on Highway 74. And then also when you look at that map, you'll see that besides that, there are towers and cells that directly cover that. You know, Sector 3 specifically of Tower 745 literally was designed to cover that stretch of Highway 74. That antenna points right north on 74. And also we know from, again, Gillette's drive test that Sector 2 of Tower 705 does also cover. So there's two other towers that cover that area, as opposed to up there at 653, where it's just like you're right on that line between two cells. It could catch one or the other. Down at 74, you're looking at the cell in question doesn't touch it, and two other cells do. So that's how we know. But that's, again, I want to reiterate what I talked about at the beginning of the episode. The sequence of the calls, more so than anything, well, not more so than anything, because I mean, that's pretty definitive already. But the sequence of the calls disproves it completely, because Tower 523 cannot connect on Highway 74 until you're beyond Tower 745 to the south. And the 713 call doesn't come in until 3 minutes after that. And even beyond how far that arc could reach over, that sector of Tower 705 doesn't have the range. It's impossible for it to reach any further than that tower. So so at a glance, you could say, well, why can this one be outside the arc and connect, and this one's outside the arc and can't connect? There's a lot more going on down there at that 7:13 p.m. phone call. And now, Zach, what did you think?
No, I really am happy you put this episode together, and the map helped a lot, to be honest, because it's a little hard to follow if you're just listening. I did both. I listened to just the audio, and then I listened to it with the map, and the map helped a lot. And it definitely breaks down a possible route for them. I mean, there's a ton of little side roads they could have taken, but for the most part, I mean, I think it breaks down a very plausible route.
Yeah.
And I think it's good information to move forward on.
Yeah. When I looked at it, the only other possible route that I could come up with was if they did in fact turn on Fred Waring towards Sacred Heart Church. I didn't put, which would give you the same result. It's a parallel road, just up one block. But the reason I don't think they did that is because it makes sense to me, because they were, because you also, when you add in what was happening on those phone calls, it makes a lot more. So the fact that we know that when they got to, the way the timing works, when they would get to that turn on Highway 74, they were in the middle of a call with Sam Gayer about the paintball. I don't think they make the turn onto Fred Waring. I think it's more likely that they would just keep driving straight as they figured out what they were going to do, which curved them around to where I showed it. And would that be the other thing I want to get up front, because Janet said we don't have questions about it, is one question that, again, didn't come up in the follow-up necessarily, but people were asking me directly, was, well, this route doesn't jive with Christian saying they drove past Lord Fletcher's.
Well, we talked about that last week. Someone did raise that last week, and we did talk about it. And I see Montana in the chat has just mentioned, like, does this route match their interviews? And some people were pretty sure that Christian was the way that it was being discussed made it seem like that people were pretty clear on what Christian or Robert had said about what their route was, and that this was in direct conflict with that.
Right. And so, and it's a good question. But this kind of comes down to looking at something on paper and then looking at reality. The biggest problem we have is when Robert was interviewed. So Robert was interviewed the next day. So I would expect Robert to know exactly what happened. The problem is, in that interview, they never asked him anything about any route. He just said they were headed to Sacred Heart. He found out it was too late, so they decided to just go up to Christian's house. And he never says that they turned around. He never says where they turned, none of that stuff. Christian wasn't interviewed until 10 days later, still doesn't get specific about the route. Where we hear the stuff about Lord Fletcher's, that comes in 4 months later. And as what I mentioned last week was the Christian was very clearly, like he says, I'm not sure I remember all this stuff. He's very unsure about where they were at. So first things first is, like I said, I didn't look at this based on what Christian said, what Robert said, what family members said, what Facebook people said, what the state said. I looked at what the sector data is actually showing us. And what I know from that is that they didn't turn around at Lord Fletcher's. It's impossible. It doesn't work. But what I want to do right now is I've loaded onto our soundboard, so hopefully this works, is I want to play for you just a quick clip from that interview where Christian talked about that route. So I'm going to play that for you guys right now. I want you to listen to it and understand why I'm saying he wasn't saying that's what they did. He was trying to remember and figure out that's what he did. So here is from Christian's interview in January of 2007.
Going back to you left his house and go on the trip, do you remember how far down the road you got? Like, give me a business or a street that you got near.
I'm not really that familiar with, like, the streets on Highway 111. Maybe we got, like, to, I'm guessing maybe, like, that place called, like, Lord Fletcher's or something. Maybe somewhere around there. Do you know that place on Highway 111?
It's the one in Rancho Mirage.
Is it in Rancho Mirage? I think you maybe got somewhere around there or something.
Is
like
that. That's a restaurant?
Is it?
Okay. So you see what I mean?
I wouldn't depend on that for anything at all. I mean,
exactly.
That's my personal opinion. My opinion is he's trying hard to come up with something. He doesn't even remember what city it's like, which
yeah, it was very uncertain.
Is in. It just sounds like he's just like,
yeah. And I only play that for the, because, you know, I just want people to understand when I'm saying, when somebody presents to me, yeah, but Christian says they turned around at Lord Fletcher's and that doesn't fit. And I'm saying when he did an interview 4 months later and was trying to figure it out, I'm not taking that, and whether it was Christian or Javier, whoever it was, I'm not taking that as the actual detailed account of where they were. You just heard for yourself. That's how it came up. He's like, I don't know. Maybe we would have went, I guess. You hear all these qualifiers in there as he's trying to remember. So I wasn't worried about that. Wasn't worried about anything besides what the sector data actually shows us. And that's what you see on the map. And again, I'm still inviting people like to go on and show me another route that works.
Now, one of the things I feel like you explained this in the Patreon to us, but I would like to have it in the episode, is you said that Mike actually explained this to you. Mike Dowd is actually the one that kind of explained you how to follow the sector data. Is that correct?
Yeah. When Mike was telling me, how to, the 713 call was an easy one because it was unanswered. It was 27 seconds. And it happened to be connected to a micro cell with a very small coverage area. So he's easily able to say, yeah, he had to be here. He had to be east of the intersection to Highway 74 when that call came in, because that's the only place that there's coverage on that tower. But what he said is, when you're really trying to track somebody, what you want to do is look at all the calls with the sector data and piece it together and build out a route. And so, yeah, that was Mike was the one that said that. And then, last week I thought, well, let's try to see if we can take this further and piece it together. And of course, I've never done this before. So I was, I wasn't expecting everything to fit together, but Mike was exactly right. When you look at it, it's like, oh yeah, especially we're lucky that they made, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine phone calls in a 20-minute drive. That makes it very easy to track them. And so it's like the 653 call, where they hit sector 3 of 707, it's like, boom, we know they're moving there. And we know almost precisely where they're at. 659, 7 o'clock, they're still in sector 1. But the 701 call is a great anchor because the call starts on one sector and ends on the other, both of which cover that section of Highway 111. Makes perfect sense. We can be really confident that they were right in that general region where they would switch from one to the other there. And then again, the 705, 706 calls, you know, it's everything just tracks all the way down, and it tracks right around past 74 and back to the east where we hit sector one. It all tracks.
Great. Well, do you want to move on and kind of get into some of the questions that we do have that maybe haven't touched on yet?
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Let's go. Well, first of all, this is just something I decided to do separately, and it doesn't necessarily have that much to do with the episode this week. But I did want to shout out Christina Rupp Cribbs, who works for the Georgia Innocence Project, for a post that was not the follow-up post, but was just a really great informative post on ineffective assistance of counsel, when it applies, when it doesn't apply, what are the standards to be met. There was a really great conversation going on there. I thought I saw you dip in there.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was a great post. So if you are interested, but you're not on the Facebook that often, I think that's a really helpful post that we're probably not going to, you know, go into everything here, but it's a great resource.
Yeah, it's great. She very clearly explains how this information could be used in habeas, and what pieces would be looked at and what that process would look like. It was a great one. And real quick before we get into other questions, I just want to touch on some responses to what I just said from the YouTube. Somebody said, well, they live there, they should know the main roads. And then somebody said, I can't imagine them driving the long way around, 35 minutes-ish, when they were about 4 minutes away from Christians. Well, I don't know what that means, because they were, you know, when they found, they weren't anywhere. At 7:01, when they found out that there was no church, they weren't 4 minutes from Christians. They were way down 111 south of Country Club then. So they were still a solid 25 probably minutes back to Christians that way. As far as knowing the main roads, it's not that they don't know the main roads. This is what I think where people are getting confused. It's the fact that they are – Christian specifically, because he's the one that was trying to route the map, or to map out the route. It's not that he doesn't know the main roads specifically. It's that he drives around there with Robert all the time.
Right.
And so trying to remember – and again, like – a lot of people are trying to look at this as, well, if they're guilty, they should know this. This was not – if they're innocent, this was not a significant night for them. They were just driving around. And then as far as the route going all the way around that way, it's easy for us to look at that map and say, oh, when they found out here, they should have turned here and here to go back. Like, they, you know, the next logical turn would have been to go ahead and turn on Fred Waring and then head north on Monterey. But you got to look at – there wasn't like this documented plan on paper. They left intending to go to the church. They found out there's no church. You can imagine a conversation. Well, what are we going to do now? Christian even says in his interview, he's like, oh, what do you want to do now? And we talked about it and figured it out that we would just go back to my dad's house. They're still driving down that road when that conversation's happening, when they figure out what they're going to do. And then they start talking to Sam. So they're on the phone with Sam – following it around. And if they did know the main roads, they'd know that from that point all the way down there at the south end of the valley, the fastest route back would be to pop back up to I-10 and get over to get to Christians. So you can't just look at it as like you're navigating on a map what would be the best way to go. You're just talking about two teenagers that were driving, their plans changed, they tried to figure out what to do, and then they ended up circling around and going back to his dad's house.
Which I would just say, like, for me, the desert, it does remind me of Tucson, where I'm from. And, you know, there's a billion different ways to get a billion different places. Like, there were just, because it's kind of a grid, and then there's also the freeway. And if you don't have a specific reason that you're going somewhere, like, if you're just like, I don't know what else to do right now, so let's just go back to your house. Like, yeah. You're not really in a hurry to get there. You know what I mean? Because you're sort of like, yeah, I guess we'll just do that. It's just sort of like... it's not like, oh, we need to be there at a certain time, so let's make sure we take the fastest route. Yeah. Like,
they
just more aimless than that. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
Evening to screw around is all they had to do. And I think one of the values in doing what we did in routing this out and finding the timing of those locations is the fact that they were on a 2.5 minute phone call. You know, they're not at that point, like, what's the route home? They're just talking on the phone and continuing down the road the way I see it.
So just in reference very quickly to Christina's great post and talking a little bit about ineffective assistance of counsel, just a question related to that. Petra says, when you refer to the defense, was there just one defense team or two? So if you can just re-clarify that for us.
Yeah, I'll clarify this all together. So first of all, there was two defense teams. There was Jeff Moore was Robert's attorney at the trial, and John Dolan was Christian's attorney at the trial. So they had two different attorneys. Those same attorneys, I believe, are the ones that filed their direct appeal after the trial. When I say the defense now, those are not their current attorneys. They both have new post-conviction attorneys that are working on their habeas. So because a few people have asked me that too. It's like, well, how can the defense claim ineffective assistance of counsel when they're talking about themselves? Different attorneys now. Those the original trial attorneys are not representing them anymore.
Great. Thank you. Okay. And then let's get into a little bit more about this episode. Kate says, is there a way you could do your own drive test and get access to your own sector data? Is that even possible?
There is. I've never done it before. I know some people that one particular is a family member of one of the defendants had told me that there's actually like apps you can put on your phone that can show you the towers that you're reaching from where, you know, from different locations. And I'm hoping that's accurate. I think he said he didn't have Verizon at a different carrier. But I want to do that because I'm really curious. So, you know, at some point I'm going to make another trip there, and I do want to do it because I'm really curious about the 709 and the 710 calls from Christian.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't have locations for those. Well, we only know he connected to Tower 523. We know from Gillette's drive test that 523 certainly has the range to reach there because he showed it making small connections on Highway 74 12 and a half miles away. So it certainly had the range there, but I can see on the map why those two locations make sense for Christian and Robert, the 709, 710, 713 call. The reason being line of sight at where I marked 709 and 710 to Tower 5. 523, it's not in a hole, but it's in kind of a low area. And then the ground kind of goes up and then back down. So that's why there's, you know, a good area there kind of directly between Tower 705 and Tower 523. Where you see 523 doesn't cover, it's because of the grade that goes up. And there's like golf courses. There's nothing there, just golf courses and some houses. But as you go down towards 111 on Cook, the grade goes up and you get that line of sight. But then the question is, well, then why would Robert connect to Tower 705 Sector 1 instead of 523 there? One reason is just a different phone, different antenna. But the other reason I put it there and I timed it, and that's about where he should be. But you'll notice where that is at is right where the river passes through and goes under the road there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look on like Google Earth and look at the elevation, that is a low where the river is a low spot that does not have a line of sight back to Tower 523 because he dips back down. But it does have line of sight back to Tower 705 right there. But so on paper, looking at the map and the topography and all that, those locations make sense, but I want to just go and see where exactly 523 connects and 705-1 connects there on another trip.
Okay. Kathy says, thank you for making that map. The only thing that would have made it better is to have highlighted the route they would have had to take to go to Becky's. And then she also adds, what do you feel is the significance of the phones being off? Does it fit with not wanting to answer Becky's calls, or does it make them look more guilty?
The reason the map is where it's at and I map the route to Becky's house is because there are no connections that show that. But I will do that because I thought about it after the episode that I want to clearly show why the sequence doesn't work of Christian hitting 523 at 710 and then Christian hitting sector 1 of 705 at 713. I can just show you that if I have further south on the map. But the route to Becky's is just 74 further. You know, you just keep on going south. But they didn't hit any towers that connect to that road, so it was left out. As far as the phone shutting off, first of all, I want to make clear, I'm not saying that Gillette was right, that map shows that their phones must have been shut off. My point was there was something more the defense should have been questioning him about. And in fact, the defense removed that page from the report when they put it in as a as a defense exhibit. In my opinion, because the state presented, you know, their experts, of course, said you could, and Bowles very directly said that you can't tell from this data if the phones are shut off or if they're just out of service. So the state, that's acknowledged through the state's experts, but the narrative the state presented to the jury is that because there was no service and there's no service at Becky's house, the fact that they had no connection is evidence that they were at the crime scene. That was, you know, they made clear that the other is a possibility they were shut off, but their narrative they presented to that jury was that the fact that the phones had no coverage puts them at the crime scene. With their phones shut off, now you've lost that. You would lose that. If it was confirmed the phones were shut off, you lose that evidence. And you would have to then pivot to what she's asking about, which is, well, if they shut them off, would it show premeditation? No, I don't think so. If they were going to do that, they would have shut them off at the house. Or they would have shut, you know, after, you know, they would have drove back up to Christian's, made a call, then shut them off, you know. It makes no sense for them to shut them off when they're right near the area. You know, they don't know how sectors work. They wouldn't shut them off right when they were right in the area where if you didn't have the sector data, it looks like you're driving up the mountain. You know, someone who's putting that kind of planning into it for premeditation would make sure to either, you know, most likely leave the phone somewhere, you know, would be the smartest thing to do. Leave the phone at Christian's house. And then drive up there, do it, and come back. So the calls would show he was at Christian's house. Because also people don't realize, this audience does, but in general people don't realize, that you're not going to get location data unless you get a call. It's not like just because your phone was in a place, they knew, you know, that they can show that you were at that place. So, yeah, I don't see any evidence that – I don't even see how you could make the argument that shutting the phone off right there after that call was premeditation.
Okay. Well, that was a question that Wes had. He had brought up the Bowles testimony that you can't determine whether a phone was off or out of service from the cell records. So you just mentioned you're not saying that Gillette was correct when he said, therefore they had shut their phones off.
To be clear,
yeah.
I think he's wrong. Because you know that map he showed Verizon's RF frequencies and there's so many colors and shit on that map. I don't know what the hell it's saying, but it reads as though that map shows there is coverage all the way up there to the crime scene. So therefore, they should have had coverage everywhere, and therefore, they had to have shut their phones off. But his drive test shows that's not true. His drive test shows dead spots all over the place. His drive test shows. He couldn't connect any Verizon towers at the crime scene. And then the locals, most locals, I've had one person tell me, oh, that's bullshit. You can get signal all the way down I-10 through the valley. But I've had a dozen locals tell me driving across through I-10 right there is a dead zone. Like it's hard to get a signal at all. And when I'm looking at the map, that makes perfect sense because there's a huge area with no towers that are made to connect there. So no, I don't think Gillette was right. The point I was making was that two things. One, it's something the defense should have questioned him about, and that could be strategic. I'm not saying that was like a error that could be ineffective assistance of counsel. It could be strategic, not wanting to get into that question. That's fine. But the other reason was because the response to our expert who came on and explained the data. My analysis, Mike's analysis, what everyone says this sector data shows, the response I kept getting was that, well, none of that matters. You can only look at the Gladiator report. And so really I was just pointing out, well, if we were going to look at if the Gladiator report's the gold standard, it says their phones were shut off. So I want to make clear that was the point I was getting at that I obviously didn't make clear in the episode.
No, I mean, look, this stuff can get a little murky, and you can do the most amazing job in the world at describing it, but that doesn't always mean that we're going to like it's going to click. And there's a lot of different stuff floating around about how to interpret that data. Alex says, can you talk a little bit about the fact that it looks like James Workman has good cell coverage based on the map? This changes my thoughts on their movements and that it seems they turned the phones off from 7:30 until that call to voicemail. We've just discussed that. So let's pull out the certainty that they turned their phones off. But do you think they had no cell coverage at the school or that they had turned both phones off completely?
Look, this is the whole deal at James Workman is extremely confusing to me because I have had multiple people. Some admittedly are close to the defendants, but some who aren't, who have told me, oh, there's no service at James Workman. I don't understand, and I'm not, and I'm not at all saying they're wrong. I'm just, when I'm looking at the map, I don't understand how that's possible. James Workman falls right in the overlap. So first of all, Tower 88 is only a mile away, and it looks like there's nothing between the tower and James Workman but an open field. And I've been back there. It's just an open field.
Mm.
And sectors 1 and 2 of Tower 88 both overlap right at James Workman. And then Tower 665 that's on the other side of the highway to the east, that tower, that's the tower Christian was connected to from home. So it clearly covers James Workman. So I don't – all I can say is I don't know. I mean, I've had people just this week saying there's got to be a way to show that there was no coverage of James Workman. And I'm just – I don't, I can't, I can only look at the map. There's, if that's true, there's some factor that I'm not seeing showing that there, you know, why there would be no, why those three sectors that all cover it aren't providing a signal.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the map, it seems like there should be, but is there an elevation change or anything that would be there for some reason?
I would have to look at it some more. One thing I thought about, and I don't even know this was a thing in 2006, but around here, a lot of the schools now actually have some, I call them scramblers. I don't know what they are. But when you walk into a lot of schools, your phones go because they, so many kids have phones in the schools that they have devices in the schools that cause phones not to work in there.
Man, that seems, I'm not saying it's not, but that seems pretty far-fetched for 2006.
Yeah, though. So I don't know if that was a thing back in 06. I know it is now. I've been in, mm-hmm. you know, my kids travel around to sport. Our school doesn't, but we travel around to sports and a lot, you'll walk in and it's like, whoop. And then the locals from that school said, yeah, they, kids are on their phones all day. So they do something to block the signal. I don't think that's a thing in 2006. I don't know. Could be if the phones were in the car where they're parked, you know, if they were, if the building was between them and the tower. That's possible. I don't know. But as far as, you know, going back to, you know, where the phone shut off, my personal theory is that I said that Gillette was wrong. What I mean is I think he's wrong that he can conclude that based on that data. My theory is that they shut the phones off. And again, when you look at the route and you look at, try to look practically at what was happening, Becky called them 6 times. During that trip, they ignored every single call. Christian called her once and hung up on her. So it absolutely makes sense to me that they're just like, just shut your phones off, dude. Like, let's just shut it off and go hang out. That makes sense. That's what makes the most sense to me.
Well, it's certainly, I will say, as a person who doesn't like conflict, I'm speaking for myself. As a person who doesn't like conflict, if I had made a decision that maybe wasn't the best decision for me or was thinking about doing something that wasn't the best thing for me, then a friend sort of pulled me out of it in some way or, you know, I just didn't end up doing it, but I knew someone was going to be upset at me for not doing it, I would want to have as little reminder of that as possible. You know what? Every time that phone rings and it's the person that I'm letting down right now, I don't feel great about that. So I'm going to go ahead and just not be able to get those calls. Like, I'm going to go ahead and turn my phone off. So yeah. That's very relatable to me. That's not proof of anything. And that's fully opinion based.
I think, and I'll tell you, there's members of the family that are like, that's not what happened. They disagree with me and they could 100% be right. I personally, just looking at the data, and everything we know, the thing that makes the most sense to me is that Robert didn't want Christian to know that he actually did want to go on that hike. That's what makes the most sense to me when you look at, you know, they talk, Christian says they made plans, then he talks to Becky, then he calls Christian back, and Christian says that he says, oh, I can't, I got to go to church, and he says, well, I'll go to church with you. Then they head to church, and while they're driving, Becky keeps calling, and Robert's, you know, remember, Robert's not the one driving. He could very easily answer those calls, but he's ignoring the calls. And then she calls Christian, and he ignores it. And then right after that, you have the call to Sam Gayer. So they're not talking. And then as soon as he gets off the phone with Sam Gayer, look at the timing, you know, within 30 seconds or a minute of him getting off the phone with Sam Gayer, Christian calls Becky and then hangs up. Like to the way, and again, this is speculation, my opinion, do not take this as fact, but the way it makes sense to me is that, you know, if Robert's just like, ah, she's just bugging us about that phone call, about that hike, I don't want to go on that thing, so I'm just ignoring her. It makes sense to me that Christian would be like, well, then, dude, I'm going to call her and tell her that we're not coming because she's blowing us up. That is, he starts making the call, and Robert's like, dude, just hang up. We don't want to have that conversation.
I think that's the most clear you've been with a theory about that Christian call that I hadn't thought about that, and that totally makes sense to me.
That's just, and again, I want to make 100% clear because somebody will be like, you're stating stuff that's not, I'm just saying this, that's all things taken aside. If I was just looking at this data and everything that we have, that's what makes the most sense to me. And then it makes sense that they would, you know, that then they'd be like, let's just shut our phones off, dude. Let's go play video games. And we heard from, I don't remember if it was Sam or somebody we interviewed that all, you know, Christian would shut his phone off a lot of times when they were playing video games anyway, because they wouldn't be disturbed, or he would get mad when people were answering the phone when they were playing video games and would tell people
to save the battery. Like there's like general. But
again, I think they shut him off for exactly what you said, that they were just trying to avoid. I mean, you can't argue. You can't honestly argue with the calls that we have that they weren't ignoring her. They 100% were ignoring her.
So no, it definitely looks like that.
Yeah, it is that. They're literally ignoring her calls, right. Then making a call, then ignoring another call, then making another call to someone right. else. They were ignoring her.
Mm-hmm.
So it certainly stands to reason that then they would, you know, shut the phones off so she would stop calling. They wouldn't have to see it anymore.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's a theory about why they wouldn't pick up if they were premeditatedly planning on murdering her too. So, Who knows? But
I still just, I mean, this keeps getting brought up, but I'm like, I don't, what's the motive? Where's the motive?
Yeah.
If it's premeditated to this point, isn't the state's theory that it was like there was a hike and something went wrong and it just so happened that this happened?
Well, the state kind of presented it both ways. They offered a premeditation charge and a non-premeditated charge. The jury didn't convict on premeditated. They did convict on like crime of passion type of thing, that something went wrong. With the state.
So that's why they keep saying premeditated, but where's the motive? They're going to drive up there to kill her because of what?
Yeah.
Why?
And why keep ignoring her calls when you're on your way there? Why is she calling them if she thinks they're coming? But anyway, we'll get back to the questions.
So a lot of questions still around things post phones being off or out of range. Caroline is looking for Robert's location from the sector data from the 1023 call to voicemail. Some frustration from all sides about the fact that we don't know when that text came in about the chapstick. We don't know when the AMPM stop was. Everyone on every side, I think, seems frustrated by that, because if we're going off of the 10:30-ish thing that I think one of the guys says in one of his interviews, then, you know, like that may or may not have anything to do with an alibi, but it's just really frustrating to not have had that followed up on much, much earlier.
Yeah, we could have a much clearer picture had they got the texts from Robert to see when that text came through and when it connected, or had they gone to the AMP. I'm with you. Like that stuff would be, but I will tell you that, and I guess this is a good place as any to mention this. This week's a weird week. After I did this episode, I thought like this is confusing with the map. And some people were telling me they were confused by the map. So I decided Sunday night to come out to the office and quick build a video, an animated video to show you how all this works to make it clearer. And now it's Wednesday and I've got about 30 hours into building that quick little video and it's still not done. So this week we're going to have, there will be a main episode, but all my focus has been on finishing up the sector data in video form to better explain it. So that will come out today when you're listening to this episode. Later on this afternoon, on Friday, that video will publish for you to watch. And then the episode for Sunday, I just, quite literally, I have to throw something together because all my time has been eaten up putting the video together. So I'm still looking at exactly what it is. I've had some listeners that are kind of on the guilty side of the argument that are, you know, that have said, you know, well, when are you going to talk about the letters that Robert wrote to, or that Christian wrote to his fiance during boot camp? And when are you going to show the pictures of Robert with, you know, bonfires and guns and things like that? And there's another interview with Claire, where she mentioned some stuff that they find relevant. So I think what I'm going to do is take some of that stuff and put it out Sunday. Cause it also is really hard to, like, I know that, you know, I want you guys to have everything. And I know the people that believe these guys are guilty want that information out there.
And some it's of them, really, I think, already have it. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of references from folks about things that we haven't covered that I think are making folks who are following along with you as you unfurl the season, yeah, making them feel like they're missing something. So I think that's a great idea. It's really important.
Yeah. And it's hard to write into an episode because it's, I mean, certainly some people think it's really relevant. I think that this stuff, that like the actual data we have that shows where they were at during the murders, is more important than what Christian said about the lunch lady at boot camp years later. But it needs to get out, so it's going to be kind of like the ugly episode, which here's the stuff that people that think they're guilty want you to know about these guys. So I'm going to put some of that out on Sunday. But just know if you feel like that episode was thrown together, it was. Because I hope that will be worth it for you when you watch the video, which is at this point is like 15 minutes long, but I'm adding another segment in there. So it'll probably be about 18 minutes long, but it plays like a podcast with me narrating this stuff, but there's an animated video that goes along with it.
Very cool.
And with that, we're all in the video. I go beyond what we covered in this week's episode and also talk about the 520 or the 1023 voicemail check call. And there's a pretty, when I really started looking at it, at first I thought, it doesn't really tell us much. Now that I've looked at it, it does tell us quite a bit actually. So, I'll be covering that in Friday's video. And then Sundays will be, of course, the ugly,
gotcha,
the stuff that they want out.
Gotcha. Let's circle back for a second to, this is a great post from Valeria, and I also saw some stuff in the chat much earlier in our follow-up about this idea of if we found the sector data or some, you know, if anyone found the sector data for Robert's phone, then what else, right? It leads you to wonder, could the sector data have been requested for Christian? And it's also buried somewhere. So that's not even what Valeria is saying, but I just wanted to point that out because that's in the chat.
And just to reply to that.
Sure.
If it is, I can't. I have searched and searched and searched and keyword searched and everything, and I have not found that right data. So 100% I'm telling you that if it's in there, I have not been able to find it.
Gotcha. Valeria says, what do you think prompted law enforcement to request Robert's sector data nearly a year into the investigation before they had the fingerprints or DNA analysis? And do we know for sure that they only requested Robert's? We just talked about that. Is it significant that despite the DNA results a few weeks later, showing that Christian was a contributor to the DNA found on the card, they didn't ask for a sector data? It looks to me like they still didn't consider them as suspects towards the end of 2007, or at least they didn't feel they had enough to arrest them.
Yeah. So again, people will say this sounds conspiracy theory. Maybe it is. But In my opinion, based on what I see in the notes that were written on the sector data for Robert and the fact that they still didn't even ask for charges to be filed after they got the DNA and the fingerprints at that point still showed no, that didn't connect to them, but the DNA connected to Christian. I think my personal opinion is that they knew that this cell phone, the sector data for Robert showed something that didn't fit with their narrative. I think they knew that it showed he passed the scene and probably the stuff that I'm going to get into with the 1023 voicemail check, I think that they knew at that point that this was a problem.
Okay. Well, that that actually may tie into Christina, same Christina we talked about earlier, who made the great IAC post, Ineffective Assistance of Counsel. But Christina notes that the case documents posted for the episode include a letter/memo from Willis to Chris Greer at Verizon. Willis writes that he's making the request for sector data based on a conversation he had with Greer the same day. Are there any further notes or documentation of that conversation? Maybe that could help us with the question that Valeria and so many other folks have about motive for pulling it.
No, there's not. And I think she followed up there asking if we have that actual search warrant that was requested, that search warrant number and what was said on that. And I did go back and pull that. So what it is, first of all, the search warrant he's referencing is the search warrant that was filed by Bumpensero on the 28th of September. So 10 days after the murders, Bumpensero filed a search warrant for Robert's cell phone records at that point. Those were the basic records that were used at trial. Looking through that warrant, I found some interesting things. And I want to break it down a little further in the episode on Sunday, because I just read it right before I came in here when I saw that question. But that's the warrant they're referencing. I will tell you now, I am highly suspicious about all of this cell phone stuff. And the closer I look at it, the more suspicious I get about it. You know, for example, they already had the cell phone information. Then in 2007, Willis calls Greer, the guy from Verizon, and has a conversation. It's like, it reminds me so much of Adnan's case with Urich calling the lens crafters about the time card. You know, it's referenced in there. We had a phone conversation. Well, what the hell was said in that phone conversation? But I don't know what was said in that conversation. But there's a couple interesting things with the warrant that I want to dive further into, and then I'll probably talk about those at the beginning of Sunday's episode when I have a little clearer picture about it.
Okay. Valeria says, did I understand you correctly that you have sector data for Becky? What dates is that for, and could it help us track some of her movements?
It's not like Robert's sector data, where it's like, this is the sector data, this is how you read the map, this is how the azimuths work, here's the site list with the cell site locations and their azimuths. It's just that in her, I think there's azimuths in her. There was nothing that I found usable, which could be because it was, you know, we know she was home. She wasn't using her cell phone at any of the relevant times of the murders. But it's just like in her phone records, it shows some sector information, which sectors she was connected to on it. And I don't remember hers were pulled in September also, September of 2006 when that stuff came in. There wasn't – the only one where there was a second request was for Roberts with Becky's. They did want to request her voicemails, and then they weren't able to get that information because her sister Tiffany had shut the accounts down. And once they do that, then Singular, I think, was her provider, gets rid of all the voicemails, so they weren't there. They weren't available anymore.
I want to shout out CC on the chat, who I think this is a really good point. I would love for you to clarify this and maybe we can deal with that moving forward. But CC says, can you explain why you keep referring to RSO, Riverside Sheriff's Office, requesting sector data as the state requesting it when there were no charges filed yet? And of course, Riverside Sheriff's Office is not the DA or the prosecutor.
Well, the state refers to everyone on the lawn. The law enforcement agent. So, and I say that because, like, when it comes to, say, Brady violations, it's considered non-disclosure by the state if there are things that the sheriff's department did that the DA didn't share. So the DA is responsible for everything that law enforcement did. So that's why I refer to them as the state. They're all like same team. You know, the investigating agency and the prosecutors are on the same team, and they're responsible for everything. So, like, it's not an argument against a Brady violation for the prosecutor to say, Oh, well, yeah, the investigator did that, but they never gave that to us. That's not an excuse. It doesn't matter. They're considered an arm of the state.
I understand that. But I think what I like about that post is just it gets a little confusing because we have stuff that the state requested years and years and years and years later as they're building a case. And we have a stuff that was originally requested by the sheriff's department, by law enforcement, using those words. So I appreciate the clarification there because it helps us remember who was working on this when and what data they were most interested in. I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
It is. But I also say that when you look at, you know, a good example of the two being tied together was when you look at the trial strategy of the prosecution. You know, as I've mentioned in this episode, when you look through this document, you see that Willis requested it, Willis received it, Willis gave it to his supervisor, Ford, who reviewed it and signed off on it, and then Willis copied it and gave it to LeClaire. So all those people from the Riverside Sheriff's Office touched this document. The state then, as this person is referring to them, the prosecution puts LeClaire on the stand and acts as though this data doesn't exist. And then when you read LeClaire's testimony, you see, in my opinion, it's pretty clear that he, you know, the way I put it in the episode, it seems to me he's in on the whole deception there, because they say, did you request sector data? No. Did anyone request the sector data? And he gets a case of the I can't recalls. Like, oh, I don't recall. Not that I can remember. You mm-hmm. know, it's very obvious when that report has his name on it. It was given to him. Right. He had it in his file. It was copied in his file and Willis's file. And the state knew that. It's very clear to me the state knew that by the way they asked all the questions.
Okay. And I appreciate that. I also that takes us to Wes and some other folks who were talking about, you know, this idea of the analysis by the state or the idea of the analysis by law enforcement before it went into the hands of the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And that the indication we have, just to clarify once more, we don't see any actual analysis. We just have these very, very strong indicators that you've just pointed out that this data was known to Riverside and the state.
Right.
Would it be a Brady violation if there was analysis, and can you request that based on the notes and this indication that this data was looked at and was known about, but there is no actual analysis or notes in the discovery file?
I mean, that seems like a really huge burden to try to prove that they did that, though.
Well, guess what? That's the problem with Brady, my friend. That's the problem with Brady.
Because you're trying to find something that was hidden.
I bet you did this, and they're like, well, we didn't. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, shit.
You're trying to find something that was hidden from the people who would have done the hiding.
Right.
To find the Brady violation.
Yeah, that seems like way too big of a burden for that to actually be a Brady.
Yeah, we have no proof of that. It's just my opinion that everything seems to point to me that they probably – because, again, once we got into this and learned how to read the data, this wasn't complicated to figure out at all. As I said last week, all Mike did was point out, which now, you know, going on 10 experts, I think, that I've talked to that work in this field have all confirmed the same thing. Yeah, it's an incoming call. You can only look at the final cell face for the location, and then you can look at all the coverage maps and show, oh, yeah, it doesn't cover 74. They couldn't have been on 74. It's that simple.
The only thing that's confusing to me is if the state had it and processed it and knows what happened, why didn't they present a different theory using it?
The state?
Yeah.
I think that has to do with the 1023 call. But again, they couldn't – they have to present evidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by the sector data, because there's some people in the chat going, this doesn't prove anything. Well, it doesn't prove their innocence at this point from what we've covered – from what we've covered now, but they could, with only the limited evidence, with the short form data, they were able to suggest, you know, even like to Bowles, like, well, he connected to Tower 745 on this call, so could that mean that he was headed towards Becky's? Yes, right. So mm-hmm. so they were able – now, if they had this full sector data and experts came up and said, well, they continued past Highway 74 before they made this call. They were headed east away from the crime scene. You and I can say, well, yeah, but they could have then turned around and then went.
Mm-hmm.
But at court, you have to present some kind of evidence that happened, and they don't have any.
Okay.
So they – right? So, I mean, if they have the sector data, they show – they missed the turn. They were heading away from the crime scene. And then the next call where they have a tower connection is all the way up at the north end of the valley up by Christian's house. None of that is evidence to even suggest they went to the crime scene. Now, I'm not saying that that proves their innocence because, like you said, they could have – could they have turned around? Yeah. Is there any evidence they did? No. There is no evidence – suggesting that they went to the crime scene. The only way they could present that argument is if they didn't have the sector data. Then they could present it as a possibility. And as far as like proving or disproving anything, as I mentioned last week, what we're looking at right now for, you know, as far as a court case goes in habeas, they just have to prove that they didn't get a fair trial. They're not, this wouldn't be something where it'd be like, oh, they're exonerated on actual innocence. It would be the state presented to the jury a theory that was impossible,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to do that because the defense didn't know that the evidence that disproves it was in their file the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the jury heard this. And one thing that Christina mentioned in her post about the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, they don't even have to prove that the jury would have acquitted. All they have to prove or convince a judge is that at least one reasonable juror may have changed their vote, which would have resulted in a mistrial, right? Even if one does. And she pointed out the fact that the deliberations for this case were 10 days long would be very helpful for the defense. So the judge will know going in, this wasn't a clear-cut, easy decision for the jury. It took 10 days to get everybody on board. So what are the odds if the defense was able to show that they were heading away from the crime scene and they couldn't have been driving towards the crime scene when the state said they could have been, could that have changed the mind of one juror? And that 10 days could come into effect. But as we know, judges are going to – who knows what a judge is going to rule on. Personally, I think if anything is right in this world, these guys, based on this information, should be ordered a new trial. They should be able to be tried. Whether you think they're innocent or guilty, they should be able to be tried in front of a jury of their peers with the actual evidence and what it shows, and then let the jury decide.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to touch on folks who understandably kind of keep circling back to this idea of other suspects and feeling like it's very difficult to help people in prison if there aren't really viable other suspects. I feel like you're probably going to say we're still just not there in terms of what you're putting your focus on. Is that fair?
Yeah, because right now what we're working on is the case against Robert and Christian. And as I said, like our process, we always, when we're in this part of the process, we're looking at everything the state had against them. That's why we're going to put up, even though, by the way, the stuff I'm going to be talking about on Sunday wasn't used at trial because I presume because it's irrelevant. As far as like legally irrelevant,
mm-hmm.
but and my process is, and this is a perfect example of it, is we take the state's case against the defendant and we put a microscope on it. And I've always maintained if they got the right person or people, when you put a microscope on the state's evidence, it will get stronger. And what we're finding is exactly what I suspected when we started this case, that the closer you look, the more the state's case starts to crumble and fall apart. It was already circumstantial, and it's becoming far more circumstantial at this point.
Yeah, I think what's uncomfortable for some folks, and I completely get it, is that, you know, putting it that way is one thing, but the idea that people are being dishonest on the state side, the idea that LeClaire is lying when he says he doesn't remember if the sector data was pulled versus just not remembering.
Yeah, let's be clear. We don't know that he was lying.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I'm just saying, like, I think that's a sticking point for folks. And I completely understand that is just, you know, some people are willing to say, well, someone could make a mistake, X, Y, Z. But that's a different scenario than there was this sort of willful conspiracy. And so I'm not saying you need to answer that. I'm just saying I'm acknowledging that there are different levels of that in terms of like what people are comfortable with believing or comfortable with speculating about. And that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And it'll be for a judge to decide. I personally think, despite, you know, the guilty side thinks this is nonsense. I mean, I've seen a bunch of people from that side that are like, oh, this won't help them at all. You know, I'll take the word of the actual post-conviction attorney over yours. But I think it will be very difficult for the prosecution to convince the judge that they didn't know that they had this evidence. And someone in the chat just said, you know, a few minutes ago said, yeah, but how do you know the defense didn't have it and have it analyzed and came to a different conclusion? First of all, what I've found through these weeks is no one would have come to a different conclusion. No expert has or has even suggested a different conclusion, first of all. And secondly, as Christina also addressed in her post, that would – For the defense to agree to that stipulation, had they already done that, they would that is a direct ethics violation, and they're just not going to risk. Not for any one case are they going to risk that. Now, is it possible? I mean, I guess yes, but also those same attorneys filed their direct appeal. In the direct appeal, one of the elements of their direct appeal by those attorneys was that the state never requested the sector data. So like they are completely like and really, really pushing the envelope, not only with, as I mentioned in the episode, by asking LeClaire if anyone requested the sector data, which is a dangerous question if you know it exists and if you think it hurts your case, they wouldn't have done that. And then also then coming and filing a direct appeal, going after the state for not getting that evidence if mm-hmm. they knew it. Like there is way more evidence suggesting that all the evidence suggests that the defense didn't know it was there. The only thing you can do to try to suggest that was is just pure speculation out of bias to say, well, I want them to have known because I don't want to believe that it was only the state that was hiding this, even though you see the analysis and you heard it from an expert that it hurts the state, it doesn't hurt the defense.
This does not prove innocence for me by looking at this, but what it does is it doesn't prove they're on their path there either. And I've yet to see anything that really is that smoking gun that shows they're guilty. And that's really been hard for me. Now, I'm not going to go out and say that I believe they're 100% innocent because I don't know yet, but I have a very hard time because I have yet to see a single thing that says they're guilty.
Yeah, and that's fair, especially with what's been covered now. That's 100% fair. And kind of what I get back to is like, well, look at this. If we're like presenting this, what we actually know, what should have been presented to the jury, you're going to have to present some evidence that they ever left that valley.
Yeah.
And what we know now is there is no evidence that they left. And I'm going to say that again. I'm not saying they didn't. What I'm saying is there is zero evidence that Robert and Christian ever left that valley. The only way that you can say they left the valley is pure 100% speculation by saying, I think they turned around. There's no evidence they turned around. It's strictly speculation. There is no evidence they ever left the valley.
Okay. I just want to shout out Vanessa, because I think, Vanessa, it was you last week, too. But if it wasn't, someone else feels just like you do. And I know that because it's a little bit of a moving target and Bob has a ton of information, has to kind of, I'm not going to say pull that thread, because he just annihilated that metaphor. I never want to hear anyone say pull the thread again. And I have Bob Ruff to thank for that. But she did say, Vanessa did say, I thought we were going to hear Javier's testimony. And it's true that weeks ago, that was the direction that we were headed. And you were excited about it because you felt like that also was indicative of kind of the manipulation, the potential manipulation of the facts or manipulation of memories or what have you. And so I just wanted to shout you out because I, too, am interested in, you know, non-sector data stuff. But I also understand that this is important.
To me, this is the most important thing we've covered yet. It's the first substantial, you know, so like what was the state's case built on? A planned hike. Robert and Christian say they never went. The state's trying to say they did, right? So that's thing one. The business card, that's super ambiguous, as we know. Yes, I agree. That's a point for the state that there's a business card with Christian's DNA on it up at the crime scene. But again, when you put a microscope on that, you've got the fact that it was found in a place that it shouldn't have ever been based on the track. You've got all the problems with the track itself. You've got the hole at the end of the track. And you've got the state's experts saying that the DNA is degraded as though it had been out in the weather for a year. So that's ambiguous. Even though it's a point for the state, it's ambiguous. And then you had this where the state, what was a point in the state's favor was the cell phone evidence seems to show that they were headed towards the crime scene. And so that's huge. This is one of the main stanchions of the state's case, is that the cell phone evidence showed they could have been, or most likely the way they presented it, headed to the crime scene. And now we know it shows they were headed away from the crime scene. But with that said, we're done with it after this week. I'm putting the video out and then we're moving on, getting back to the rest of the case against Robert and Christian.
Okay. Well, that is all I have. There were some other great questions, but I think we've pushed in over an hour and there was a lot to cover. So shout out to anybody who I didn't get to, but a lot to chew on from this episode.
Yep, that is. And I think it's a good place to stop. So again, for this week, everybody, today, this afternoon, I think I'm going to, my goal is to have it up and published by today, Friday, at 2 p.m. Eastern time. So if you go to our YouTube channel, the Truth and Justice YouTube channel, the video version of episode 46 will be up there. It'll be 15 to 18 minutes. And I think it explains all of this much clearer and makes it easier to digest. And also I break down the 1023 voicemail call and beyond. So because that's the big thing that we're looking at. I want you to know as you go into that, you've got two ends of the cell phone evidence, right? The first half of it was, were the guys headed towards the crime scene? We've shown that they weren't at 7:13 p.m. And then it's just unknown, right? And then you have 10:23 p.m. where the state says that that's when they came back from the murders and turned the phones back on and connected. So that's an important one too. And of course, again, there's another one that ambiguity doesn't even begin to describe that, you know, at maximum they had to make that drive in 38 minutes. Bodmer was able to and present to the jury a trial. They did it in exactly 38 minutes. I think this video is going to show you that should also be thrown out. So that said, check out the video on Friday. Sunday, there'll be an episode that is going to be some of the uglier stuff around Robert and Christian, because we just need to get it out there, and I don't know where else to put it.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks, everybody. See you next week. Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Edited by Kelly Behrens Brink, and all music for the show was created by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by me, and all of our fonts across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Viola, Erica Cantor, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Ford, Courtney Wimberly, and Melissa Cardenas. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in several ways. financially support the show, the best thing you can do is just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You'll not only be supporting the show, but you'll get something in return. On Patreon, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes bonus video content every week. Then other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also do us a huge favor by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the brands that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page on Facebook. For all you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found in all forms @BobRuffTruth. Janet can be found @JanetVarney. And Zach is @Z2TheQ. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. As for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
I had to close it out because I couldn't. I was just like, I can't even process. It was a busy one today. There was just too much to even.
All by myself. Just all by myself again. Lots of loneliness. Lonely, lonely times in the studio.
Howdy.
This is really lagging.
Guys, let me know how my volume is because I can make some adjustments here.
Yeah, me too. Tell me that I'm better sounding than
can
Bob.
Can you hear me? Okay, because we did some stuff.
I'm kind of an idiot. A little bit.
Oh, yeah. Let's get that new photo up there.
I don't want to put a nude photo up there. That's weird. You send them to me anyways. That's weird.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Thanks, everybody. Why am I the only person saying
goodbye? Well, I wanted Zach to say goodbye.
Goodbye, Zach. Thank you, guys.
Kelly, clean that up to just say thank you, guys, so it doesn't sound like we're idiots. And then I'll finish with this. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Whose is the tea?
Oh, that's for me, thanks.
And the fish fingers?
Me, please.
Over here, you two.
Dobby's restaurants have great deals on lots of tasty products.
That's it. Mind your backs, please.
Making them feel even greater.
Left a bit careful of that.
So kids' meals feel larger than dining tables.
Set it down. Gently.
Whoa. Find great value every day in store, like Kids Eat Free. After all, spring's a big deal at Dobby's Garden Centres.
Anything else?
Have you got a bigger fork?